to Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome to the 251st episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 250 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C, so that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio show, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. Before going any further, some announcement for locals in the Hudson Valley. On Tuesday, October 23rd, there will be an open house at the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center in Flipsy Manor Railroad Station in Sleepy Hollow, New York, from 5 to 7 p.m. For more information or directions, go to writerscenter.org, and that's writerscenter.org, or call 914-332-5953. The next evening, Wednesday, October 24th, there will be the monthly meeting of the Yorktown Poetry Workshop at 6 p.m. at the John C. Hart Library in Sherbrooke, New York. I coordinate that group. Finally, the next night, October 25th, is the weekly meeting of the Mayapak Writers Group, now in its 21st year, at 6:30 p.m. at the Mayapak Library on 6th in Mayapak, New York. People wishing more information on any of these events may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. I hope you'll join us next week at the same time for an interview with poet G.R. Hummer, and every week at this time. Then up to this week's guest, as mentioned, the 251st in the series. My guest is a library director of the aforementioned John C. Hart Library in Sherbrooke, New York, Patricia Bradigan-Holland. The listeners wishing to join Pat and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I usually hold conversation until near the end of my guest, by end of my conversation with my guest. Let's get started. Welcome to the show, Pat.
Oh, hi. Happy to be here.
I don't know if you noticed that today's New York Times book review has a review on the library book by Susan Orlean. It's about the L.A. library, and it starts off with the fire there, but it's really about walking through the library to look at books and everything. It looks like it's a fascinating book.
That looks like a good one. I did not see today's New York Times book review, but I had read about that. Was there also an article by or a compilation of 12 authors talking about their public libraries? Was that in today's issue?
I didn't even get beyond the beginning, then getting ready for the show and submitting some poetry. But I have it here next to me, so I will look. Where'd you grow up then go to early school?
Oh, I'm from Bensonhurst section of Brooklyn, and I went to elementary school at the Our Lady of Guadalupe on 73rd Street and 15th Avenue.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
My earliest aspirations? I can remember in sixth grade telling the teacher I wanted to be a missionary. By seventh grade, I wanted to be a writer. By the end of eighth grade, I was fairly sure I wanted to be a teacher. And I stuck with that. I did stick with that through college. But the year I graduated from college, if you have my resume in front of you, you might remember that year more than I can at the moment. Went to 77. There was a New York City hiring freeze. And we were encouraged our senior year to explore other careers. In fact, the school got a small grant to. I went to a small commuter college, St. Joseph's College in Brooklyn, in the Clinton Hill section of Brooklyn, and the school had a small grant for us to look at other career choices and what our skills and our interests were. And I was out sick for an extended period of time. I missed the whole thing. And some of the sisters of St. Joseph who teach there were a little worried about me. What was I going to do? And the school librarian came up to me one day, handed me an application to Pratt Institute, to the School of Library Science, and an application for a fellowship, said, fill these out. I'm going to Pratt this afternoon. And I got a fellowship to study library science at Pratt, and I did that part-time while I worked full-time.
Boy, you're way ahead of me as to where I was going to ask things. I noticed there was something I was invited to at St. Joseph's this week, I think. There was some event out there. Were you an early reader? Did you read it?
Yes. I was not the best coordinated child. I could run pretty well, but everybody rode a bike before I did. My solace was in reading. In fact, I may have, somewhere around the third grade, my mother just one day said, okay, no more reading. We're going to take you out and you're going to join the Girl Scouts because I'm tired of you sitting here and reading books. But yeah, I read before I was out of kindergarten. And then I kind of ignored the first 3 years of school. I was so tall. I was in the 52 desks in the room. I was always in the back seat and I always had a book in my desk. So I missed some of those early years.
How about your high school years? Did you write for a school paper or the literary journal, or did you work in the library? Did you do anything relating to books and writing and reading?
Most of the writing I did, we had a school newspaper in, the middle school years. In elementary school, I wrote a serial article for that. I'm trying to think if I did outside of class. No, I did, we did have some creative writing in class. No, my interest was speech and debate. In fact, I was involved in what they called extemporaneous speaking and made it. You wouldn't know that by me talking now. But I competed in these tournaments in Brooklyn and Queens, occasionally in Manhattan, and and I actually made the nationals twice. So I got out of Brooklyn, and we to a tournament in Pittsburgh, and then my senior year was Chicago. And I got to meet a lot of really great people, different people, learn a bit about how, you know, people from other parts of the country, you know, live. And you, whenever you put a group of teenagers in a room, a lot happens. And that was a very good thing for me.
Yeah, I had similar things in the service. I was only in for 6 months, but I wound up in Oklahoma, and I saw really segregated places there, and it was just awful. But it was an eye opener. And then you're off to St. Joseph's. Did you what did you major in college?
English. I was English with a minor in education. I also minored in history.
Okay. And while you're going to Pratt, you worked in the corporate world. What did you do there?
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to library school. I wanted a job in a library. And I through someone I met in school, I got a job. I had been working in an investment bank prior to that, but that was it was a glorified filing position, but they called it researcher. I liked that, and I got a job in the Chase Manhattan Information Center. Now this is I want to say it's before the internet, but it's before the internet was what it is now. There were no personal computers. But research facilities, you know, some of the big universities and large corporations were able to exchange information online. You needed to know certain codes. There was, as I said, there was no PC. There was no, graphic user interface. There was no, you needed to know some codes. You would connect via what did we call it? I bet you know what it is, but
Telnet.
Telnet. There were two of them. When one was out, you used the other, right?
Yeah, your Telnet remote locations, and you had to know the address and everything. The internet, it was there, but it really didn't take off to consumers till the first web browsers were introduced, and then it was
1990
like,
or maybe a little before. Yahoo 90, being the...
Yeah, but 93 was when first the web browser out of the University of Chicago came in, and then after that, obviously all the others. So mm-hmm. they did very well.
Well,
so,
Chase,
back
I
to
actually.
You.
Oh,
no,
I'm
Chase,
sorry.
Go ahead.
Oh,
so,
Chase
back
actually
to you.
Subscribed. Oh.
Yeah, Chase, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I keep messing up. But at Chase, they subscribed. They were one of the first subscribers to the New York Times Information Center, where you could search through all New York Times articles. We also had access to legal information. And anyway, that's what I was learning at Pratt. Not a lot of people were learning that at that time. So what I like to say is, I was very employable. I had this great set of skills that are now totally obsolete, which is kind of what the library world almost is. You know, it's built on all these things that pass us by, but it's also about learning and moving on to the next thing. You know, it's a place for lifelong learning, and certainly working in libraries all these years, I've had to learn as I go along, because you know the only constant is change.
After 11 years in the corporate world, you moved to the academic world. What brought on that change?
Oh, I wasn't 11 years in that. I was much shorter than that. Chase Manhattan, by the way, after that first fellowship, which covered 12 credits, Chase paid my way till I got the degree. And they sent me to a conference in Washington where NYU was interviewing. They needed a librarian for their Graduate School of Business library. Now, it had been my dream to work in an academic setting, Plus, I very much wanted to get out of my mother's house, which, you know, it was really hard to do. I don't know that people nowadays would understand that, but, you know, in this Italian neighborhood in Brooklyn, you had to have somewhere to go to. So I wanted a job in Boston, or I wanted a job in D.C., and I got hired by NYU. So I was just a short subway right away and didn't quite get out of my house. But I worked for NYU Graduate School of Business. I'm not even sure for how long now. I would have started NYU in 1980. Oh, yeah, July of 1980. I left them in 83. And what happened in the meantime is as a condition of my job, I needed to earn an MBA, which I could do, you know, I could in between working because I was right there in the building. And I really did love some of those courses. The computer applications information systems were very easy for me. I mean, not that I know much about computers now, but it really built on what I had been doing at Pratt. I loved the management classes. I loved the marketing classes. In fact, as the librarian, I actually taught two classes in the marketing class because it was all about where to find the research and the data. But I was never going to pass accounting and economics. It just wasn't going to happen. We're not without my giving up the rest of my life. So I thought. So I began interviewing, and I was hired by the Westchester Library System. Now, what had happened in the meantime is I'd gotten married. I met my husband June 1980, right before I began working for NYU, and he worked in Boces in Yorktown. So at that point in time, we were down in Yonkers. We were hoping to buy a home. We thought we were going to end up in Putnam County, but we ended up in Peekskill. But while I was working in Yonkers, living in Yonkers, I took the job at the Westchester Library System. And what I did for them, I was based most of the time at the Mount Vernon Public Library. Incredible building, incredible collection. They were the central library for Westchester County. They kept all the books nobody else had space for. They put an enormous amount of state money into reference books. And little libraries, like the John C. Hart Memorial Library in Shrub Oak, New York, would send down to Mount Vernon to get some of the more difficult questions answered or to borrow materials when they weren't even sure what they wanted, subject requests. And it was my job to do that. I also was doing the online searching. There were online databases. They still exist in some form, but now they're more usable. The whole gamut, Medline, Education Resource Center, even things like biology and chemistry, which are outside of my field, but I could sit down with the people who needed the information and determine what the terms were and what it was they needed to find and work with them to get them what they needed. And you know, that again, that doesn't exist anymore. We have the internet, some of the smaller colleges didn't even have online access back then. So we would get some of the nursing schools. The graduate nursing programs would send us students. There was a professor at Marymount who did a lot of research and the students in his seminars, some of their searches would come to us. So it was very interesting. It was a lot of fun.
You also did some adjuncting during that time to Westchester Community, didn't you?
Oh, right, because as the service grew, and this is, again, typical of libraries, as the reference and research service of the Westchester Library System grew, the staff did not grow. So I would find myself in an effort to get through some of these things, staying later. And then it dawned on me that, if I really had the time to stay later, why don't I just take another job? So I was an adjunct at Westchester Community College. I worked in the library on Saturdays, and I worked there two evenings a week. And let me tell you, as a young married couple, this was wonderful. When I went to work for a Saturday, I would net $100 for the day, which we thought was a lot of money. And while I was gone, my husband would clean our whole apartment from top to bottom. It was just, you know, I need to go back to a gig like that. That was nice. I will tell you one funny story about, understand, I had been in libraries to this point, but I wasn't doing a lot of interaction with the general public. It had always been special. It had been, people at Chase Manhattan Bank, the credit trainees, people looking at investments. It had been the students at NYU Graduate School of Business, or these other requests that were funneled through the librarians of all these libraries around the county. So now I'm at Westchester Community College, and anybody who walks in can ask me a question, and I'll help them. And I was having a difficult time. There was one particular student who would show up every Saturday to work on the same psychology paper, and I couldn't seem to get him to understand what he needed to do. You know, you've chosen your topic, how to go about finding the materials he needed to for the research part of it, which is really the part that I supported. And there'd been a couple of interactions, but there was one person in particular. So one day I said to my husband, why don't you come to Valhalla for lunch, come a little early, and sit there and listen to me, because I'm doing something wrong. I'm not communicating well. I'm missing, I'm just not getting this across. There's got to be a way I could do this better. So he comes and he takes out a book and he sits there and reads his book as I'm talking to people from the reference desk. And when I asked him for the feedback, what could I be doing better? How can I communicate better? How can I, help them with their research? He said, I don't understand why you're helping them at all. These people are crazy. And I think of that from time to time, because, that's not really an option. When you're in public libraries, you really have to help people, do your best to help people and keep trying.
Absolutely.
Never occurs.
Was Joe Hacken the president then?
Yes, he was. Yes,
yeah,
he was
one of my early. He was one of my early guests on the show. So he's a very, very nice man. Yeah.
As an adjunct, I did not run into him, but later, after my youngest daughter was born in 1990, I had three small children. I was working full time, and a part time job opened up there, and I thought it would be easier on the family if I took that. And I made it through the interview process right through his office, sat down, met him, and that was just a pro forma thing. But when I left, I'll never forget it, I'm on 9A, and I stopped for a red light, and I fell asleep at the wheel. And I said,
wow.
It sounds stupid now, Peekskill to Valhalla, that's the easiest commute in the world. But at the time I was commuting 6 miles, I was close to home, and that's where I needed to be. So, that 28 years ago.
In 1985, though, you did come to John C. Hart, and I know that there's been many changes since you've been there. The automation of the library services, the library movement into digital collections, the expansion
mm-hmm.
of the library. Could you take us through some of the challenges that you've had to face?
Well, when I got there, it's actually more than twice the size it was when I first walked into there. So they were in the middle of a huge building campaign. The automation of the collection, the patron catalog, they'd been building up those bibliographic records, but now we had to go through and put smart labels have been generated from bibliographic records we had, and we had to go through and put them on the books and identify the things that did not have bibliographic records and get them cataloged, and that coincided with the building of the library. And at that time, Ignatius, the seminary up on Stony Street, was it?
Oh
St.
yeah,
Ignatius
it used to be.
Loyola?
It used to be the Jesuit House of Formation.
Right.
Then it became the
Phoenix
the
House.
The Narcotic Rehabilitation Center. Right.
Right.
Now it's a school. Yeah.
Yeah. So the librarian at Phoenix House had worked at Hart, and they had these huge library stacks that had been part of the seminary library that were empty. So she arranged for us for the parts of the collection that normally would have been put in boxes and stored while we built the new library, she arranged for those to be on open shelves at Phoenix House. And we had access to the collection. And most of the work for the automation of our collection took place in Phoenix House. You know, the library at that time had moved into two classrooms at the what is now the Capellini Center. And I missed a lot of that. In March of 88, I went out on maternity leave. I was back in July of 88, and then I went out on maternity leave again in February of 90. So I moved the collection out of the old building. I worked with the automation on and off, and then I was back in time to move the reference collection back into the building. But talk about automation, we opened the 1990 building, or soon after we opened, we had Westchester Community College had automated earlier than the public libraries did in Westchester, and their catalog they put a terminal at the John C. Hart Library, so we had access to their collection and were able to use some of their online resources, and that was put there because there was a big continuing education program, actually it was an off-campus program at Lakeland High School at the time at night, and they felt that a lot of the students who were attending that satellite program would be using us as a resource. We also opened up with one standalone computer that was maybe linked up through CompuServe or something like that. But Westchester County was a little later in getting their online catalog up and off the ground. There had been a move to join the county and have it hosted on the county computer. Only White Plains took advantage of that, so they were automated before the rest of us. It was the Westchester Library System felt that they needed to have the servers, have physical ownership and be able to maintain that on their own, and that took some time. But of course now it's, you know, everything moves so quickly, and it's those days are like, as I said, a lot of the skills we needed back then are now almost totally obsolete.
You also moved into digital collections and began to giving out CDs and everything. How was that taken by people that were used to dealing with books only, and all of a sudden they must have thought you were in the music business when you really weren't? But
well, so when I was there, we still had a record collection, when I first got there. And that we were thrilled to see CDs because next to CDs, records are much more fragile. But we never had a huge music CD collection. Our larger collection is the CD audiobook collection. And some libraries are actually seeing those collections shrink because now, of course, we have downloadable audiobooks, some great services online, free. You download it right into the app. But right now at Hart, ours is an expanding collection. And one thing that drives it, it's the aging population. That's one thing. People who are becoming less comfortable reading because of vision issues, and the commuting. We're still a big Yorktown is still a big commuter population. Newer cars don't have CD players.
Yeah,
and I don't know if you've run into that. So, we could talk to people about downloading to things like their phones and plugging it in. We also have a collection of what we call playaways. They're like little MP3 players. Those are expensive, and it's hard to get all the titles we want, but we have one of the larger collections on that. And you can use a cable, an inexpensive cable, to hook that up to your car. And for people who are running into that problem, we actually have cables that we'll check out, so you could try it out and see if that works for you. And then, eventually you're going to want to buy your own because we only check them out for a week at a time.
A full service station. Yes, it must be that the older people you mentioned who don't have the reading skills anymore, they also probably would not be comfortable downloading apps to devices. So I can see there still being a market for for the CDs, for the DVDs.
Now, we had a program this summer where we paired teens. We had teens available, not just at the library, but also at the cultural center where the nutrition center is, to teach people to download books, because what we are seeing is more and more people have smartphones. Even regardless of age, if you walk them through downloading the app and downloading the book, and the apps have gotten easier to use, but they do need someone to sit there and do a mini lesson for them, and they also need to feel free to come back when they're having a problem. So we're trying to smooth that over for people. Now the kids, I just had two librarians were invited to Lakeland Copper Beach Middle School, and they interacted with, I think it was 8 classes of English students, teaching them how to download books to the various apps. And the assigned reading, the summer reading and the classics and that kind of thing are more and more available online. It used to be the digital. We would have wait lists for digital titles, and now we're moving into, not us, but the publishers are making available, always available titles, which is great for the school market. So I could have 12 copies of To Kill a Mockingbird, but the third week in August, if you want to read it, you might just have to download it because it's not. Oh, if you want to read it tonight, I'm sorry.
You mentioned all these functions. How are local libraries funded? Where does the money come from? Is it from the town or is it from the central thing or from the state? How are they funded?
Okay, so you're going to be sorry you asked. There are three types of libraries in New York State. Our library is a municipal library, so most of our funding comes from the property taxes of the people in the town of Yorktown. Where I didn't do the numbers for this year's budget, but it's 96 or 97% funded from the Yorktown taxpayers. We also have a contract with the town of Cortland. There's a huge unserved district. It's made up of people who live in the Lakeland School District of the town of Cortland. If you live in the Lakeland School District, we will issue you a library card. There are three other libraries involved in that contract, Peekskill, Montrose, Croton. They'll do the same. And I think I'm going to forget exactly. I think we got $380,000 from the town of Cortland this year. But the services, a lot of the services are centrally supported. We're part of the Westchester Library System. Part of our budget goes to the Westchester Library System to support these services, but there's money from Westchester County and from the state of New York that support some of what I'm talking about, some of the IT functions. Remember I said how I worked at Mount Vernon, which was the central library, and they had state money for book collections. Most of that state money now goes to support digital content. So that's one huge way. There is a bill that may be before the Senate right now, or maybe it's gone to Cuomo's desk. Yes, it's waiting for the governor to sign it to take some of the state library money. Oh, no, to empower the state library, to buy digital content on a state level. So we would all be still contributing to it, but we would have the purchasing power of the entire state. And, that's really, so Benjamin Franklin thought it was a great idea to share books. We had public libraries, and we had public libraries before we had royalties, publishers and royalties. And so for 100 plus years, libraries have been buying one copy of a book and circulating it to anybody who wants it. When digital publishing comes, they say, wait a second, this is crazy. Why are we going to sell one copy to a library and let them, let anybody get it? Not only do they charge us more, or they used to, some of that is changing now because it's market-driven, but not only do they charge us more for a digital copy, but we have to buy multiple copies to make them available to more than one person at a time, which, there's multiple copies at whatever it is, $80 a copy or $90 a copy. So libraries badly need to band together and to do this kind of statewide or, consortium-wide. We need to push the marketplace to be more favorable to the library.
Now,
did that
mentioning,
make any sense to you?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
I have questions on it. The money that comes from the property taxes,
mm-hmm.
is that collected by the municipality and in some way then negotiate with you how much the budget goes to the library and how much goes to the basketball courts or whatever?
Yes, and actually, out of curiosity, I went back. Our budget for 2019 will be increased. It was increased slightly in 2018. So I said, well, we're getting this a bigger piece of the tax pie, or it looks like we're getting a bigger piece of the tax pie. So I went back in time, and I see that consistently from the town of Yorktown, the John C. Hart Memorial Library has gotten about 4.5% of the total tax appropriation. So we're being funded at about that level, or at least for the years that I looked. I forget how far back I went. I think I went back to 2005. Did I mention that I never would have passed accounting or economics?
That you're talking now, probably could have.
The thing is, without without my being prepared for it and written out in front of me, I'm going to mess it up every time. I have to slow down and think very carefully before I start talking dollars and cents. But I could do it. And
the two courses that I wish that I had a better grounding in and paid more attention to than college were economics and physics, because they became so important as we moved along, both in the internet and in the different theories. The other question that I have on the, I know that there is with the digital content, there is only so many copies that it can have out at any one time, just like there is with the physical books. But as a computer person, it doesn't make sense to me why you can't have only one copy of the book, and as long as you keep track, you're only allowed to lend out eight copies at a time, or 12 copies, or whatever. What is the insistence on that you must have individual copies of the books?
Okay, that's driven from the publisher, so that they make more money. Okay, so if I want to have more than one copy, I need to keep purchasing it over and over again, even though it probably only costs a few cents for them to duplicate that. They're going to charge me, as you know, $80, $90 to buy additional copies. That model is changing. So one of the confusing things about the digital content in libraries is that we're using multiple vendors, which means, of course, you have to download multiple apps. You might even have to, we're trying to have all this included in our public catalog so that you find them in one search, but you may even have to search within apps to get the, you know, to really make sure that you've looked completely for what you want. But there are some models that pay per download, and this makes a little more sense. So we've got Hoopla is one of them. Hoopla, we buy on a county level. It's the Westchester Library System. That's one of the services that's being paid for out of the state money that comes to the Westchester Library System. So you are limited to 5 downloads a month as a way to try to control the budget on that. But we pay per download, and we pay a few dollars per download. So the publisher, the vendor, Hoopla, not the publisher, the vendor puts together all these thousands of titles that could be downloaded, e-books, audiobooks. That it also includes this service, movies and music. And then you, as the patron, with your library card number and your PIN number, can find what you want and download it, and the library system gets charged only for those things that get downloaded, and as I said, a few dollars per download. So that's that's a great thing. So take a book like Wonder. I don't know if you would. It was a movie. It was a movie with Julia Roberts, but there's this, this absolutely terrific book, Wonder. It's a children's book that really everybody should read. Palacio, R.J. Palacio. Anyway, this summer we showed the movie, and we also borrowed copies of the book from other libraries, so we would have multiple copies for people to take out. But it's also available as a download on Hoopla, so we could just, you know, in our publicity, we could just link to the demo. What I had hoped we would do is people would read the book and talk about the book and come see the movie, but we didn't quite get it together that way. But if you want to read Wonder, you can just download it. It doesn't matter whether we have 20 people who want to read this book for a discussion next week, because we can, you know, many of those people might choose to download it to their device instead, either as an ebook or an audio book.
Okay.
Or both. You know, audio is great for kids who are I was going to say struggling readers, but you know, they're all different developmental stages. But if we, you know, if I have somebody, if I assign a book to a kid, it's because I want them to get something out of the book. Not that I assign it, but if a teacher, or they want to get something out of the book, they want to discuss the book. There's information in the book, and the printed page can be a barrier to some students. To it's a hurdle they have to get over before they could even get to the point where they're getting the information or the theme or the, you know, the content of the book. So to read a book and listen to it at the same time is just perfect for students like that. And initially we did that by trying to make sure that we had a core collection of CD audiobooks as part of our teen and children's collection, but now a lot of that is digital content. And you know, sometimes the best thing we could do for a teacher is show them how to get access to the content for their students who are going to need it.
Sure.
What else? What else did you need to know?
Well, I got a whole lot of stuff left. The library hosts many functions, including the poetry workshop that I coordinate and after school programs. Could you take us through some of the programs that the library has that we may not be aware of?
Yes. Well, you know, I'm going to mention money for a minute because it's that time of year when we talk about money. But we have in our budget, we have $15,000 for programming, which is really a kind of a drop in the bucket. We're very happy to have it. But we have this wonderful fundraising group, the Friends of the Library, and they pour another $20,000 into the library, and most of that money is used for programming. So I just walked over to my computer to look at my Google Calendar to see what's coming up this week. Well, first of all, library serves birth through death. So we have a number of what we call early literacy programs, but that doesn't really tell you much about them. We start with our bouncing babies, which is a caregiver and a baby, and there are rhymes, and there's reading aloud. We have toddler time, and tales for tots. Those are our early literacy programs, and then we have drop-in programs for children. Some of them, you know, anybody who wants to come in can come in. Music and movement. We've got a toddler. So tomorrow, the 22nd, we have a toddler yoga program. And then we have rock and roll for little ones, which is a music and movement program. We have a play group at 1 o'clock. And the evening at 6 o'clock, we have Pause, P-A-W-S, to read. Therapy dogs come in, and children read aloud to the therapy dogs. So it's reading, it's language, it's movement, and socialization, and this is available to children preschool. Pause to read children, that's for readers regardless of their age, and reading aloud to dogs it's fun, it's non-judgmental, nobody cares if you mess up a word, and the dogs are wonderful. I mean, I just go in and look at the kids reading for the dogs, and it just, you know, that makes turns a bad day into good. So that's for the little ones, and I think I just hit Monday. We have some drop-in programs for adults. We actually don't get too involved in these programs. We make the space, we set up the tables and chairs, but anybody's welcome to come in and play chess at noon on Mondays. And that's actually worked out very well for us because one of our biggest problems is programming space, but chess is quiet, and they could play it anywhere they can find tables and chairs. So you can do that anywhere in the library. We have Canasta, which is drop-in, a Mahjong drop-in, and some volunteers who come and play Canasta are doing a Canasta, a Learn to Play Canasta class. They did one for a couple of weeks, and now they're doing another one. Senior Benefits Information Center. This is the Medicare enrollment period. I should mention that. So this is the time when you change your Medicare Part D. And so Senior Benefits Information Center, these are volunteers. They're trained on county level. It's a program of the Westchester Library System. They meet every month. They're up to date on Medicare benefits and other benefits related to health and well-being. And so you could come in any Tuesday at our library. They're at other libraries and other days. And counselors, again, volunteers, will help you with your benefits needs. And this time of year, if you bring in all your medications, well, they'll do it any time of year, but this is a time of year to get it done. All your medications with your doses, how much you're paying, they will help you find the best Part D plan for you. For seniors, especially people who need to come in with older children or relatives who may be working, we run a full day just for this Part D enrollment, and we'll be doing that on Saturday, November 10th. So the hours advertised are 10 to 3, and that's because if you come in after 3, they probably aren't going to have time to help you, but our volunteers will be there all day. What haven't I? Teacher in the library, so 2 days a week. This comes out of our town budget. We pay a teacher to be there to help one-on-one with homework. And this is for elementary school children. This Tuesday night, we're showing a film called Resilience. So one thing we want to do as a library is to have community conversations, to touch on some of the topics that are important to our community and have a place where people can come and learn more about them and have open discussions or mediated discussions. Resilience is a movie that deals with the biology of stress. There's research out there, very solid research, about how childhood trauma and stress in childhood affects you throughout your whole life. So that a lot of the risk behaviors, smoking, addiction, people who score high as having been in anxious, ACE, I don't know what ACE stands for, I'm trying to think, but trauma, stress-related situations are more likely to engage in these behaviors. There are certain diseases that they're more likely to have, heart disease, diabetes. And the good news about it is that when we put support systems in place, when adults and children can go for support, we could counteract as communities some of the effects of childhood trauma and childhood stress, which follows people their whole life, and you know, we could break some of the cycles. So the Resilience Coalition in Westchester County has been using public libraries to show the films, and they send out the mediators, and we'll be doing that Tuesday night. Trying to see what else is on this calendar. Oh, we do fun things, too. Today, you missed it, Casey Morabito-Green has written a play and that she performs, and it's based on the WHUD Shine On spot that she does on Sunday mornings. So it's stories using celebrity audio from recent guests and experts and presents an hour of motivation, inspiration, and fun. I just read her description of it. That was there today, and I fully expect that there were about 70 people in that room today, and I'm hoping it wasn't either too warm or too cold. There were things we do throughout the year just to bring families out and have them share things together. We have craft programs for adults that are very popular. We've been offering them in the evening. And then we do a lot of informational programs Often, hospitals, businesses provide community speakers. So I see that we have a menopause lecture coming up on Friday at 3, followed by the teen Halloween craft, okay, which means that we have to quick clean the community room and put some chairs away and put out some tables. But pajama story time, which is going on while your poetry workshop is going on. According to this, it's going on in the same room. I'm going to have to do something about that. You're going to be in the community room. I could see that right now. You'll be in the community room on Wednesday. Pajama story time is in the story hour room. But
you mentioned the crafts thing. I went to one of those with my wife, who knows some women that are active in the earring building, mm-hmm. and that was terrific. And apparently you make one for yourself, and you make one that's given to people in hospitals and in old age homes. Mm-hmm. I think that's a terrific thing.
It is, and you know what? Really, first of all, we all of us need an outlet. So it's a way to get out of the house, do something creative, and it's very social. And when you get right down to it, a lot of what's happening in the library, you know, we've done a lot. We started talking about digitization. We've talked about the computer age. In the library, we provide support to seniors who are learning how to use computers. Well, actually, anybody could walk in, but it's aimed at a time for seniors because they're the ones who were kind of shut out, who didn't grow up with this. But with all the automation, we're fragmenting ourselves, and we need a place where we could come and be together. And, I think I mentioned it to you earlier. For me, one of the best places to do that is the book group. When you read a book and discuss it as a group, and for me, because I do the book group I do is known as the Wednesday book group for men, but anyone is welcome. So it's the Wednesday group book for men, everyone welcome. But the books tend to be more nonfiction. Our discussion in November, and that book could be picked up this week right through Wednesday, is on Custer's Trials by Stiles is the author's last name. And the book puts General Custer, what's his full name? Armstrong, something Armstrong.
It's George Armstrong Custer.
Right, okay. He's a very interesting character. We ran across him in a book we read over the summer, The Earth is Weeping, which was just a horrendous story about that. Right. So he's, you know, an emancipator who's a bigot, an officer who's been court-martialed, was it twice? He's an opportunist, but he's also, there are a lot of contradictions in his life. And the little bit I read about the book, I haven't started the book yet, is that the author's object is to put him in his times. This is a rapidly changing period in American history. And there's a lot of conflict on a lot of different levels. And he seems to be right. You know, his life seems to reflect that. So I'm looking forward to reading that.
I believe one of the officers who actually took part in arresting John Brown at Harper's Ferry before the Civil War, before any of this stuff.
So that was Custer. Okay.
Yeah, he's a young officer. Yeah. There are some questions about the library. Do we all know some of the stuff about it, but we may not really understand it? Like what exactly are stacks? What is the criteria of something going into the stacks?
Well, I'm trying to think about this. We have always traditionally, and we kind of stick to that. It's based on material on reviews generally. So So if I'm my section to buy for in the library is I'm forgetting now. I do the 800s, which is poetry and literature, you know, literature, writing, essays. I do the 400s, which is language learning. That's where your dictionaries are. And I do 001 to 199, which is we've got all our computer books in, as well as, you know, books on unexplained items, tarot cards, mysticism, but also a lot of the self-help ends up in there. That's a very strange section. But anyway, those are the sections I do, and I'm buying based on reviews. I find most of my reviews, actually, I've moved almost to a completely online buying system where I'm getting pre-pub alerts from different journals, and the reviews I look at most are in Booklist and Library Journal, but I also rely on some of the list serves that pull things out from other places. And the vendor we order most our books from is very good about organizing books by subject that I can browse, and most of those books will have reviews too. So the Kirkus reviews are in that. We get Kirkus at the library. I don't generally have time to read it. Publishers Weekly reviews are in there as well. So that's, we look for reviewed material, but that's not enough because the stack space is limited, and because so it's also driven on what's gone out before. So I might get the best reviewed book on, can't think of it, I don't know, I'm trying to think. Okay, let's say there's a new book on Windows 10. I look at the collection and I see every Windows 10 book we have is out. I'm going to buy the new book on Windows 10. There's a very well-reviewed book of poetry, author unfamiliar to me or familiar to me, it doesn't matter. I look up and see how this author's books have gone out in our library before, if we don't have any libraries like ours. And if I see the last two books haven't moved, I'm not going to buy it.
Okay.
So that's the patron recommendations are welcome, by the way. And then the other thing we do at Heart, for years I was there and people from the community would come in with things that they had written. And sometimes, I have to say, I just got handed one last week. Sometimes when I look at these things, I think they're the only person in the world who wants to read this, and sometimes not. But it seems wrong when we're trying to be a community of learners and we're trying to support lifelong learning and we're trying to support creativity to say, no, we don't want your book. So what we're doing at Heart is if you are a local author, and which I have been working on a description of what a local author is. You know, is Carmel a local author? Well, right now it is, but well, anyway... if you are a local author, we will get your book cataloged and we will put it in the collection. But we don't interfile it with the other books in the collection. We display it as our local author community. Now the fiction is a lot. I just spoke to fiction and to the local authors. The fiction is a lot harder. It's we have one librarian, I don't know what we would do if she left, who's very, very plugged in to the publishing world and to the online blogs, and in addition to the sources I mentioned. And so she's keeping a close eye out there, and we still miss things. She's in addition to her doing that, other librarians on staff will pick up the print copies of Publishers Weekly and Kirkus Library Journal and make recommendations to her from them if we don't see that they're already on order. But despite that, there are always things that all of a sudden we need four copies of that kind of got away from us. So for those things, I place an order with Barnes & Noble every week. But because of municipal, the way we have to order things, requisitions, and it's not like going to the store and picking them up. The best case scenario, it's 6 business days. But still in all, we want to fill patron requests. And that's people should be able to find what they want. And also, if they've requested it, there are probably 10 people out there who want to read it who didn't request it. So,
on a completely different topic, every library has the children's section. Is there any monitoring to what children are reading in the library or taking out?
Oh, well, yes. Now that, thanks to this online catalog that began emerging in the mid-80s and just gets better all the time, we're moving. Westchester Library System now is working on a migration to yet another system that's supposed to do more and be easier to use. We get very good statistics. So we know what people are taking out. We get weekly reports on what titles have holds on them. Now there's another dimension to this. You mentioned children's, but it goes a little bit beyond children's as well. There are things that kids want to read, and we want to have them. So I'm trying to think what those are. Dog Man is one right now. As soon as the next Dog Man book comes out, they want to read them. But we also want to have collections quality reading, things we could steer people to, especially children. Supporting the curriculum is one thing we're interested in, but another is just having quality material for them to find, whether they're going to, hear about it wherever kids hear about things, television or from other kids or, commercials. One thing I know, I worked with some great children's librarians over the years, the first one being Florence Stevens. Florence would never in a million years have a Barbie book in her library because that's not quality. We have them because kids ask for them and they should get what that's their choice, and what they choose to read is going to build their reading skills. But we also want to have really quality books to balance that with.
Do you ever get pushback from the community the way there were over the years? There were these things about Catch and Rye and then the Judy Blume books or other books that there were some people that thought that they didn't want their children reading that kind of trash or whatever.
We have a procedure for challenging books. We are not likely to withdraw something from the collection on a challenge. I mean, that sounds a little, holier than thou. The first thing we do is, why did we buy this? So if it's something unknown, I've had people come in and say this book is full of horrible words, or it's really violent, or it's. Movies are harder, by the way, why did we buy it? Well, here's the review. How many? It's gone out 6 times. I'm not going to take that book out. You choose not to read it. That's fine. But then the comeback is, well, what if? What if a 12-year-old takes this book? What if, what if you have that? I had this with movies. I had a woman very upset because there was a new version of Animal Farm, and it had the packaging on the DVD made it kind of look like Babe, the okay. Movie about the pig, and so she took it out thinking it was a nice animal movie, And she was upset by that. She felt the packaging was deceptive, that children will take it, and this is not a movie for children. But it was in the adult collection. We don't monitor what kids themselves take out. We leave that to the adults in their lives. That doesn't mean that I might not personally point. So I remember once a kid came to the desk. I was helping her mother, and she came to the desk with a copy of you would know it as soon as I said it. Oh, come on. Lady Chatterley's Lover. I'll tell you a story about that. My sister was in college. I have this. My sister Winifred is 7 years older than I. She went to St. Joseph's College, and she was in college, and she was going to read Lady Chatterley's Lover, among other things. She gave me a list. I went to the library every week, and people in my family would give me a list. She gave me a list, and I don't know how old I was. If she was in college, you know, if she was a junior in college, I was in seventh grade. And so I'm in sixth or seventh grade, and off I go to the library, and I go to the adult room, and I give my list. And I thought the librarian was going to have a heart attack. And they did not give me Lady Chatterley's Lover. But 50 Shades of Grey. There we go. So a kid comes up to her mother and says, Mom, I'm going to read this book, 50 Shades of Grey. And mother said, okay. And, you know, I really don't believe in it. You've got an avid reader. Anyway, I don't believe in saying no, but 50 Shades of Grey was just a little bit too much for me. So I turned to the mother and said, do you know about that book? She said, yes. I said, okay, you might want to read some of it first. And she said, oh, no, I know what it's about. I encourage her to read. Like, okay. But my son is still an incredible reader. And he came home reading the Lestat books, Anne Rice. And, I don't know whether he was in seventh grade. He was in middle school. It would have been sixth or seventh grade. And I was a little taken aback by that. I'd never read them. But I heard that they had some pretty explicit sex scenes in them. So, I know first thing not to do is you can't read that book because, of course, he's going to read read it right through. I would. So, you read. And he was very interested in vampires. So, I understand how it came into his hands. So I said, I see you're reading whichever one it was, and Interview with the Vampire. And he said, yes. I said, do you like the book? He goes, yes, I do. And I said, I'm asking about it because I haven't read it, but I've heard some people say that there's some pretty steamy sex scenes in that. And he said, oh, yeah, I skip right through those. You know, they don't want to read that stuff.
Yeah, she was a real. Another question, though, you'll know something about. Does much revenue come from late returns and from other finds, like lost books and stuff?
Okay. If you were to look at the town budget, they expect that $45,000 is going to come from finds this year.
Wow.
Finds,
that's a lot of money.
It's not going to happen. Not going to happen, and we knew it wasn't going to happen. Last year, we made about I don't remember 32, maybe a little more than that. Maybe 32 is what I'm expecting to come in this year. Now, here's the deal: you could go online and renew your books, right? If you choose to keep a book late because it can't be renewed because somebody else is waiting. A lot of people say, I need it for two more days, 20 cents, you know, and they'll do that, and that's just fine. But I don't think there should be fines, but I don't think we should be depending on these fines for revenue. I had been trying to phase them out of the budget. what we've just moved to, and so you could ask me this question in a couple of months. In August, we implemented something called automatic renewals. If you have a book out that you took out at our library, and now a lot of other libraries are doing this as well, but we were one of the first to have it turned on for us, which wasn't such a good idea because it didn't work well the first 2 weeks. But anyway, you take a book from our library. If nobody's waiting for that book, and if we have your email address, you will get an email 3 days before it's due saying this book has been renewed. And it's renewed from the original due date. So you get, you know, if it's a DVD and it's out for a week, you get another week. If it's a new book, it's out for 2 weeks, you get another 2 weeks. If it's a regular circulating book, you get another 3 weeks. And, it was my gut feeling that the people who are going to benefit from this were a lot of our seniors who will not come out if it's raining, or any kind of bad weather, or who really worry, even though they're not worried about paying the dime. That's not what worries them, but they feel guilty that they haven't returned this book. And the other thing we're seeing is, or hearing in our children's room, is kids will pick out a stack of books, you know, 6, 7, 8 books. I want to take these books home. And you'll hear somebody say, no, because if we don't get them back in time, then they're, you know, we have to pay money. So automatic renewals are a good thing. I think they're going to encourage circulation. But I don't know yet how they affect our fine revenue. I know that in large library systems that have implemented this, they saw a decrease in fine revenue of 6%. And I'm going to have to look at this over a period of months, and I'm also going to have to look at it against the circulation, because revenues have been declining because book circulation has generally been declining. We'll see that our say nonfiction collection declines at a rate of about 3% a year. And people are finding information in other places. Some of that has moved to digital content. It's our foot count, the number of people who are coming into the building, had been going up. There was a slight decline in September. I'm not sure why. But so it's not that people aren't coming in, but there is a decline in circulation, which would lead to a decline in fine revenue as well.
Okay.
And yeah, lost books are nothing matter. You lose something, you pay for it. But as far as things being late, I would love to see us, now DVDs have larger fines, but the books, I would love to see us have no fines on children's books. And there are two libraries, actually three libraries in the county, I think, that are doing it. Yonkers does it manually. If you return a book to a children's room in Yonkers, when they check that book in, they forgive the fine. White Plains does not calculate fines on children's books, and I believe the other one is Mamaroneck. Larchmont and Mamaroneck both suspended fines on children's books over the summer. That I do know.
That makes sense. Where families are going away and the kids want to take the books with them. Yeah.
It does. And also, you know, we forgive a lot of fines as well. I mean, you don't want to punish people for reading a book. Anyway. But we do want books back.
Haven't I asked you, libraries in general and to John C. Hart in particular, that the public should know?
Public libraries in general and John C. Hart in particular. The funding issue is getting tougher in New York State in general. Municipal libraries are being hurt by the tax cap, and that's something we struggle with. It's not, I'm not advocating going to the streets and ticketing, but we need to think about how important these services are in our life and how we can keep them going, and not just next month or next year, but what we're looking at for the long term. Something needs to change with the way we fund our libraries. I mentioned before that there were three kinds of libraries in New York State. There's a school district library where the library serves a certain school district. Let's see, Chappaqua is a school district library. Ossining is a school district. Mayapack is a school district library. And their budgets go to vote. I'm beginning to believe, I'm kind of afraid to say this out loud, I'm beginning to believe that we need to do more of that, that more of our budgets need to go to vote. People don't understand that the library is governed by a board of trustees. That's something people don't understand. All libraries are either they're elected, as they are in the case of school district libraries, some municipal libraries as well, or they're appointed by the municipality. It is the library board of trustees that has power under New York State education law to decide how money is going to be spent. In some municipal districts, the municipality gives the money to the trustees, who then have a treasurer and their own financial people. If we were to do that, that would bankrupt us. In terms of funding, what to know about the John C. Hart Library. We are the third busiest library in Westchester County. What that means is that we circulate more materials every hour we're open than do 35 other, there are 38 libraries in the county, than do 35 other libraries. So you're looking at some, I'm not looking at the statistics. I know White Plains is one. In terms of total circulation, we're fourth. Yet we're one of, we're certainly not small, but in terms of square footage, in terms of the size of our collection, we are somewhere in the middle of that 38. In terms of the amount, if you take all the library budgets and look at per circulation cost, for every item you circulate, how much does it cost? We're very near the bottom, if not at the bottom. So, could we use more money? Yeah. Are we doing well with the money we have? Yes, we are, and we are proud of that. Can the town afford to give us more money? I don't think so. And, a municipal library our size, for example, is Greenberg. And Greenberg, the town of Greenberg has a lot more going on in terms of retail dollars and, corporations and manufacturing. That's not happening anywhere near that extent in Yorktown. Yorktown, it remains the property taxpayer who's paying. And as I said, I don't think that money is there. So how do we look at other kinds of funding? You beat me. beats me is what I was going to say. But we need to figure that out. And I would like to make some strides with that. With generating more revenue. Unfortunately, when you look at your budget lines, when we talk about the money we're spending, we're talking about it in tens of thousands of dollars. But when we're looking at the money we bring in through fundraising or through other sources of revenue, we're looking at thousands of dollars. It's a hard thing. One thing we did, and actually I like this. This works. People take a lot of online courses, and they need to have their exams proctored. And one of the places they could have their exams proctored according to the places, they, you know, the institutions they take these courses are. One of the people who could proctor exams is a librarian. So, yes, we will proctor your exams. And we've always said, yes, it has to be around, you know, somebody has to be available to do that. So we need to have some lead time. We need to, you know, it has to work into our schedule. And if and you walk in the door and we proctor you, and we've kind of stopped that. If you walk in the door and you have our library card, well, of course, we'll proctor your exam. And if you don't have our library card, we'll charge you $30. And it seems to be worth it to people to spend $30 for that. So, you know, but how much am I making on that? You know, how much of that's going back into our budget? You know, if we make $300 in the year, that'll be a lot.
Okay.
You know, so it's, but we'll, you know, what more like that can we be doing? We want to be in a position, you know, public libraries, one of the terms you hear when people talk about public libraries historically, they are free and forever free. So, yes, we're going to charge you to print, which is a relatively new service. You print something from the computer, we're going to charge you to photocopy. But we're probably breaking even on that. We're not really bringing in, you know, all that much money. And what else can we charge you for that also provides you with the kind of service you expect from your public library? I mean, proctoring exams is one. Renting rooms for some library has worked. Some libraries have worked very well, but we have two programming rooms. Right now, our policy is not to rent space, but even when that policy is changed, and it will be changed, how often will a room be available when somebody wants it? Probably not that often. Fundraising. And fundraising requires a lot of volunteers. I cannot use tax dollars to fundraise. That means that if I'm engaged in fundraising, I'm doing it as a volunteer. It's outside of my work hours. You know, and what kind of fundraise? So who's going to do it, and what will they do? But we need to do some more of it.
Yeah, there's a lot there to be considered, obviously. What's next for you personally?
For me personally, what's next? Well, I'm looking forward to retiring. I told the library board that I gave them a year's notice. I'd be happy to go out anytime in 2019, but they need some time to find a replacement. And also, we're involved in a couple of exciting projects that I would like to see through with the bathroom renovation, the never-ending bathroom renovation. We have a state grant. It's currently out to bid. This is the second time it went out to bid, and I'm really hoping that this project will be done early next year. I wrote another smaller grant, New York State Construction Grant, to replace the fluorescent lights. And that's been recommended to go to the next level. And as soon as I get some confirmation on that, we'll start replacing the fluorescent lights, many of which the ballast and things are breaking over and over again anyway, and replace that with LED lighting, which will be more cost-effective. Let's see, what else is going on? You know, those are two projects I need to get going. I'm kind of in a, I know there are other things we want to do. We have a new website. That was a big accomplishment, and one that, I mean, I did a lot of work initially on this, but it never would have happened without our staff, led by Allison Egan. So this is totally homegrown, and the beauty of it is that we could change it effortlessly whenever we need to update it. What
you
else?
You mentioned retirement plans. Do you have any definite retirement and plan? Is something you want to do? Travel?
Oh, something I want to do. Yeah, sure. Well, my husband retired in 2012, so we would like to travel more. You know, I stepped in as interim director in July of 2015, I began a certificate program, a management certificate program, soon after that because there was a knowledge gap there. I'm finding to move things forward in the library, when my kids left, I was taking long walks. I'm not finding enough time for myself. I'm not even reading enough, which is terrible. So I'm looking forward to doing more of that kind of thing. My house can use some organization. My husband's been home, and he's been doing a lot, but it's time for me to clean out the basement and the attic and think about possibly moving out of the house. Where to right now is undecided. Trips. We've been talking about getting to Ireland forever. And last year at this time, I said, well, the bathrooms at the library will be done by March. Let's go to Ireland in April. And the construction never started. So maybe that'll happen this year. There are some things we want to do while we're still, like Ireland, for me, the perfect Ireland visit would be a lot of walking every day. And, you know, you never know when those knees or hips are going to stop working. So
I know that. My basketball ankle. We've covered a lot of bases tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about you?
To know about me?
Yeah.
Now, basically, I'm a very boring person right now. It's just library, library, library. I live in Peekskill, New York. I've lived here for 34 years. Is that true? 34 years. And one thing I'm really enjoying, now I mentioned those walks, so, you know, today is Sunday. We get out a bit. You know, it's a non-library day for me most of the time. There's just a lot to do and see so close to home. And that's fun. So just enjoying community and neighbors. I have my daughters live in Philadelphia, another great place to be. I've been trying to get there for a while. We're gonna do a weekend. We think we may go. We haven't made solid plans yet, but it looks like November 3rd, 4th, and 5th I'll be in Philadelphia. And, you know, weather permitting, we'll be walking through Philly and having some fun there. The reason we're leaving Saturday and not before is my husband and I are going to do a midnight run that night, November 2nd, which is something we do with the Church of the Holy Spirit. And, you know, that might sound like I'm like a really good person, but I do it because first of all, getting ready for the run gets my mind off all my library, what I perceive as library problems, and onto something else entirely. We give out food and clothes on the streets of New York City. A lot of local groups do that, and it just makes me feel good. I like that.
My wife and I, whenever she's not teaching or we don't have something, we work in the food pantry on Saturday mornings
St. Mary's. Yeah. And I may have mentioned this, and this I miss. Since the work has picked up, it's not that I'm working so hard, it's just that my hours, you know, the library's open a lot of hours, and many of those hours I want or need to be there. So I don't have a set schedule, but one thing I had been doing was once a month I would cook for the homeless shelter. And again, it's an incredibly feel-good thing, you know, to bring a home-cooked meal to, you know, down to Jan Peek House and, you know, to talk to the people who are helping, all kinds of people who are helping themselves with food. So it's nice. It's good. I hope to do more of that.
Okay. Pat, thank you very much. It's been
a real
pleasure.
You're welcome. Okay, take care. Bye.
Send any comments or questions to me about the show to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. Be sure to join us next week for an interview with poet T.R. Hummer at the same time. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in the book. And as they say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Let's go off with the Eagles. Amazon, play Take It to the Limit.
Take It to the Limit by Eagles on Amazon Music.
Thank you very much, everybody, and good night.